Hello, my name is Kate Rolls and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 27th of July 2009 at 2311, and if I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth and where you come from.
Hi Kate, my name's Tim Jones. My date of birth is the 9th of July 1980 and I come from Liverpool.
And how are you today?
I'm really well, yeah, I'm good. I've been looking forward to this.
Good. And if I can just take you back to when you first heard about the project,
yeah,
and ask what it was that sparked your interest and motivated you to apply.
This is perhaps not the ideal response, but when I first heard about the project, I'm not sure that I was aware of Anthony Gormley's involvement. I've certainly been a huge fan of Anthony Gormley's for quite some years. But I think when I first heard about it, as no doubt a lot of people have, I mean, I read an article just today that compared the project to Big Brother, and I think I sort of perhaps initially thought, great, another opportunity for people to, you know, make stars of themselves. It was perhaps slightly cynical. Until I think the day it started, I work very close to here, and I walk past her every day on the way to work. I walked past and I saw it and thought, wow, that's fantastic. I'm standing here staring at someone who frankly could be stood next to me on a tube platform. And were they stood on a tube platform, I wouldn't really give another thought to. But because they're standing on a plinth, okay, yeah, what does that mean? And that certainly got my attention, and I looked into it a little bit more from there.
Right. And that's really interesting that it was seeing the work and kind of already in existence that made you apply, and kind of you were inspired by the piece itself.
Oh, very much so, very much so. And that's certainly been borne out by my experiences subsequently. You know, I think initially there was a tendency for there to be more sort of performance art going on the plinth. People felt maybe obliged to sort of do some kind of a show. Actually, what I've enjoyed most is just seeing normal people on a plinth and standing around, tourists and whatnot, during the day, and all this attention spotlight onto this person. I mean, the very notion of a plinth in the first instance is to sort of to mantelpiece something, you know, is to put something on show. And I think there's something very interesting about being encouraged to just look at other people. And it kind of, you know, you stare at whoever's up there, and great, you know, if they're doing something interesting, fantastic. If they're not, whatever. But either way, you're looking at a person and you're very conscious of the fact that they are just a member of the public who's applied to do it. And then you stare at them for a few minutes, you turn around and you go on your way, and all of a sudden everybody else that's around you, you think, well, I could be looking at you, or I could be looking at you, or I could be looking at you. So yeah, it's certainly, in terms of my enthusiasm for the project, something which has been quite heavily borne out by experiencing it, I suppose.
Brilliant. And when you decided, when you found out that you got a place and you were going to stand on the plinth,
mm-hmm.
How did you decide how to best use your hour or time up there?
Okay, well, there's maybe a degree of mea culpa here. I actually only found out that I was going to be on the plinth yesterday, and didn't expect to be on the plinth in the first place, but thought, well, why not stick my hand in. Got the place, thought, great, well, what is it that I most enjoy about it? And thought, well, yeah, okay, so there's certain charitable causes or messages that I would love to broadcast as a stage. Certainly I would not criticize people that choose to use the opportunity for those reasons. I think as a piece of art, it works most strongly just as having living, breathing, normal human beings on a plinth. And what does that tell you? I mean, that really reflects what I was talking about before. I think that's the really strong suit of the project. So yeah, it's frustrating in one respect, because you think, great, this is this enormous stage that I've got and this opportunity to, you know, say stuff, and definitely, you know, one wants to say stuff, but I would rather people just, you know, looked at me and I was just myself. So I brought a few books with me, and you know, I'll probably call my parents.
No, I completely understand where you're coming from with that. What books did you bring?
I'm reading a few books at the moment. I'm one of these horrible people that gets halfway through a book and thinks, God, what do I feel like reading next, and buys five other books, and you know, or borrows five other books, and so on and so forth. But the books that I've brought at the moment, one that I really should have finished a long time ago, is the second book in the Philip Pullman trilogy, His Dark Materials, which I'm really enjoying and a little ashamed I didn't read when I was slightly younger, but have been sort of piddling around with for a while, and so I'm going to finish that. And I also brought Nicholas Taleb Nassim, I forget the guy's name, I'm afraid, but the dude that wrote Black Swan, that's been all over the, you know, press and whatnot recently. A friend of mine that I visited in Germany was reading it, and I'm always slightly dismissive of these sort of fad type books, but he convinced me that it was good. So I went to buy it from a railway station, and it came free with the first book that he wrote, which is called Fooled by Randomness. So those are the two books that I have. It's the Philip Pullman book and the Fooled by Randomness book.
So you're going to read and be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Your clothes that you're wearing, are they clothes that you would normally wear in everyday life?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. And can you just describe what you're wearing for the archive?
Sure. I'm wearing some brushed slip-on shoes, some sort of charcoal-y, dark charcoal grey socks, some grey jeans, a blue V-necked sweater with a bit of a collar thing, a white shirt with sort of mauve pinstripes, and a dark burgundy tie.
Oh, thank
you. That's okay.
great. And can you tell us a little bit about you? What do you do for a living, first of all?
Yeah, of course. I'm a legal advisor for the government. I'm based with the Treasury Solicitors Department. Often takes a little bit of explaining. People tend to think that I work for the Treasury. I don't actually. The Treasury Solicitors Department is one of these governmental anachronisms, I suppose, in the same way that the Prime Minister of the day is the First Lord of the Treasury. So the government solicitor, or one of the government solicitors, is the Treasury Solicitor. And the Treasury Solicitors Department do work for a lot of different Whitehall departments. I'm presently based with the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, whose offices are just a couple of doors away from here in Canada House on Cockspur Street. And the work I do there currently consists mainly of advising on the legal implications of policy revisions to gambling licensing, alcohol licensing, some work on the Olympics, heritage listing, buildings listings, applications, so on and so forth. It's a fairly broad portfolio, but I enjoy it a great deal.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, no, it is. It's good. I mean, my background is more in the arts, I suppose. So to be a lawyer, and to be a lawyer that's interested in government, and end up being able to work in something that has a real, genuine, meaningful product in the creative industries is quite satisfying.
Yeah. And are you part of I suppose you're, as a team, how is it to kind of work and be part of that, and to play such a significant role in society in that way? Do you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a huge part of the reason that I chose to do what I wanted to do was, I suppose, in finding a stakeholder that was not all about the bottom line on the balance sheet. I came into law through the music industry. I ran a recording studio in Liverpool for a few years. My academic background was in English and art history. Subsequently, I did a business degree in the music industries. Ran a recording studio, became increasingly interested in intellectual property, digital rights management, I mean, this is a very exciting time, really, potentially, for the music industry. A lot of music industry moguls would perhaps say it's a terrifying time, but it's a very exciting time in terms of how the industry is going to develop. And increasingly, I became involved in the legal implications of that, not intending actually to leave the music industry. I thought, well, great, I'll get a law degree and I'll go into law. I think while I was doing law and becoming increasingly disenfranchised by the music industry and how sort of commercially driven it was, that I started to think, actually, you know, probably I was watching too much West Wing at the time as well, but actually, you know, it matters more to me that I do stuff that affects everybody rather than actually stuff that, whilst, you know, in the long cold watches of night, I might like to think are benefiting the kind of guys standing outside McDonald's playing their own songs, busking, trying to get a record deal. Really, all it's doing is benefiting the sort of larger corporations of the music industry. And your imperatives in the music industry are very much driven by those kind of commercial concerns. So I think I thought, yeah, you know, much better to try and do something which actually affects everybody. And that's when, you know, when I became particularly interested in working for the government. I work for the government. I don't necessarily agree with everything the government does, with everything the government says, disagree with a lot of it, but nonetheless, you at least have your hand on the tiller, so you can kind of try and have some input in what happens. That's a very rewarding feeling, and that's, I mean, to answer your question in a roundabout way, but to actually come back and answer your question, that's almost the single most important part of what I do and why I carry on doing it, I suppose.
Yeah, brilliant. And you said you're from Liverpool originally. Ooh. When did you move to London, and what sparked that move, and how you found that?
To answer those questions in reverse, I've enjoyed it a great deal more than I thought I would. I moved to London having lived in Melbourne, Australia for a year. And I moved to Melbourne having found out that I had a job in London a year hence. Essentially, if you want to work for central government, you pretty much have to live in London. And I was sort of acquitted myself to that. Went to live in Australia for a year while I was waiting for my job to open up in London. I think had I have moved straight from Liverpool to London, it would have been kind of an uprooting. I'd studied away from Liverpool and St Andrews, and I'd lived away from Liverpool before, but Liverpool had always, and still does, you know, feel very much like home. There's that great joke that people tell, I'm sure they tell it in other cities too, about how they do a poll to find out what the second city of the UK is. And obviously, you know, they're trying to work this out, and they go to Birmingham and they ask the citizens of Birmingham, okay, what is the second city of the UK? Everyone in Birmingham says, well, Birmingham, you know, naturally. And the same question is asked of the people of Glasgow. And in Glasgow, they say, understandably, Glasgow. Manchester, the result is as you would think. Yes, of course, Manchester is the second city of the UK. They come to Liverpool and they ask, what is the second city of the UK? And again, the populace are unanimous in their response. They say, well, of course, that's a silly question. London is the second city of the UK. And I like that story because I think it reflects something that, I mean, I feel myself I think if you come from Liverpool, you have this very idiosyncratic attachment to the city, where you really do feel like it's the centre of the universe. And I was always very reluctant to uproot myself from that in the long term. Having lived in Australia for a year, though, Melbourne is a tremendous city, one of my very favourite places on earth, and has so much to offer that I think moving back to any provincial city in the UK, and this is certainly no failure of Liverpool, but any provincial city in the UK would really struggle to rival somewhere like that in terms of the amount of stuff going on. So then I think that made coming to London quite a bit easier. You know, it was somewhere that also had so much stuff going on, and that's been really nice. So yeah, no, I enjoy it. I think it helps if you kind of can find a part of London and make it your own, you know, because if you try and take the whole city at once, it just doesn't happen. It feels foreign and unfamiliar.
And I suppose it must feel not so far away from Liverpool as well, having been all the way to Melbourne.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, that's absolutely right. I have some family in London, and it's nice now, having spent a year so far away. It's nice now to be in a place where, yeah, I can see my parents every now and then, and I can see my sister and my nephews, my niece, and other family. You know, it's, yeah, you're right. Actually, that's certainly a very good point.
And what are your ambitions or kind of goals that you have, that you've set yourself in life, or that you kind of would like to achieve?
That's fine. I think, yeah, I don't know if it's good or bad that one can't answer that in so many words, but I think you have degrees of ambition. I think, God, I don't know. You stand there and you stare at the sky. You think, I'm significant, really. What is the point of me being here? I mean, on the basis level, you know, I think my ambition is to have a family that I love, and to give my children, I mean, I've been very fortunate, but to give my children a better opportunity still, and hopefully imbue in them something of the sort of ideals or aspirations that I've had myself. Not to want to live totally vicariously through them, although I will be guiding them very strongly in their decisions. But I think to make somebody happy, you know, when the lights go out, to have made somebody happy, and if that's my own children, then all the better. On a grander scale, I mean, certainly I have personal ambitions one day wanting to write, wanting to go into politics, wanting to, I don't know, just make stuff better. It's a strange question. It's one that ties in very closely, I think, with your, one's always reluctant to bring religion or spirituality or any of those other sort of hackneyed terms into the conversation. But I think if you think that everything ends with yourself, then I don't know how you justify doing anything, because really that's it, and I suppose your children are it, but then why have children, you know, it goes on and on and on. So I suppose you believe in something, and when you believe in something, then you try and make that something as good as you can. So yeah, I suppose these are all details. I would like to write, I would like to be in politics, I would like to have children, I would like to give my children a great opportunity to do this, that and the other. Ultimately, I would just like to make stuff better, I suppose. And that sounds awfully fuzzy, I realise, but
no.
I don't know what else keeps people getting out of bed in the morning, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult question, and I think it's just nice and important to think about it now and again, and to kind of to be constantly asking yourself that question.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. You're taking part in this project now. Who are you taking part in it for? Who are you doing this for?
Well, for everybody. I don't know. I mean, I don't know intimately what Anthony Gormley's idea for the thing was, but I would assume, I know that he's sort of spurned this notion of public art, and I can see why, you know, in theory all art is public, but I think some art is more public than others, and this is a very public piece of art. So I suppose you're doing it to try and affect as many people as you can. I mean, I'm okay, the short answer, I'm doing it for myself so that I can tell my grandchildren in 100 years' time that, you know, see that plinth with the big statue of the RAF guy? Well, you know, I stood up there once and this is what happened, if I'm honest. But by the same token, I love it as a project, and I wouldn't have, you know, equally I could probably try and scale the Houses of Parliament and tell my children that I stood up there. I wouldn't, because it's not part of something so wonderful as this. And I think what is wonderful about this is that potentially anybody, I mean, you know, it's on the web or what have you, anybody can look at it And it's nice that anyone can look at it and say, well, that's a normal person, okay, and have the same feelings that I had when I've looked at people up there, and just maybe slightly change the way that they think about other people. I hope that doesn't sound too Jesus complex, yeah. But okay.
No, I think that's the real beauty of it.
Yeah.
You've kind of already answered this, really. So,
okay.
But what impact do you think it will have, the project?
I guess that really depends on... I don't know what the plan is in terms of follow-up or lasting legacy. I don't know whether there are... I noticed I had to sign something that talked about the National Portrait Gallery and talked about other artistic institutions and what have you. Presumably the footage that's being recorded is being... Sorry, the footage that's being broadcast is being recorded, and presumably there will be some sort of... Not permanent necessarily, but there will be a thing that exists after the... You know, after the 100 days are up. I appreciate that's probably not your question. Your question is more, what impact will this have going forward? I answer in very pragmatic terms, because I think, sadly, that it will, you know, if this was to be the extent of what happens, then hopefully it will have had a lasting impact, because millions and millions of people will have seen it, and it will have had the kind of impact on them that I've described to you a couple of times now, in terms of how they think about people and stuff, and that's great. And hopefully they'll take that away with them, even if they don't realise that they're doing so. It will maybe just very fractionally change the way a lot of people think about the world, and that would be great. But I also think it would be nice if the project does not die on the 101st day, but does perpetuate in some capacity. And in so doing, maybe then gives other people an opportunity to have those same thoughts. And I don't really think it matters that much that they're not seeing it happen live. But if people, you know, if the project exists somewhere in some time and is shown and is what have you, then I think that's really nice. And it will hopefully continue to have the impact that I described to you. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Kate. Thank you very much.
Is there anything else that you would like to say?
Thank you for the opportunity. It's really nice. I hope you're not terribly disappointed by my utterly, utterly apathetic appearing display on the plinth, where I plan to put out a seat, have a little read, a glass of wine, possibly fall asleep for 5 minutes, phone a few people. One feels that, you know, you should use it as something, but I just think that that's not really the beauty of it.
You said you might phone your mum and dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do they think? Do they know that you're going?
Yeah, they're really excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.